Chapter 5. A Special Providence. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. William Shakespeare, Hamlet. And for myself, I am fully convinced that there does exist in nature means of selection, always in action, and of which the perfection cannot be exaggerated. Charles Darwin, Natural Selection. Before he leaves Daphne's north rim, Peter Grant stoops and scans the dirt by the path. With his floppy-brimmed sun hat and gray beard, he looks both cheerful and grave, reading the dust. He is hunting for a tribulus seed. There was a time when you'd just say, "There's one, there's one, there's one."
"Now you've got to search for them," he says.
He kneels beside a tribulus plant, or what is left of it. After almost 4 years of drought, the plant has withdrawn to the roots. It looks like a black claw hiding from the sun. All around it, the lava is coated with layers of old guano, and the glare on this white paint makes Peter squint, even though the morning sky is still overcast. He brushes aside a pebble or two. "Here's a trib," he says at last, holding it up in his palm. "The tribulus plant dropped this mericarp during the last wet season to wait for the next wet season. Now the plant is a withered stump, and the mericarp, still waiting, has bleached to the color of driftwood. Though it is guarded by two long, sharp spines, this mericarp has been chipped open at one end. Within this broken place, Peter can see two dark pod holes side by side, like tiny eye sockets, both empty. Just two seeds taken out," he says. At this moment, up and down the volcano, 400 Darwin's finches are doing what Peter has just done. They're turning over pebbles, inspecting the lava, raking the cindery dust with their claws, sometimes poking their heads down into dark crevices, looking for the last bleached seeds. To open new ground, one of them will sometimes brace its head against a big rock and roll over another rock with its feet. A finch that weighed less than 30 grams was once seen rolling over a rock that weighed almost 400. That is like a man rolling a boulder that weighs 1 ton. It is the labor of Sisyphus. And unlike Sisyphus, Darwin's finches cannot keep it up forever. They are wearing down the horny sheaths of their beaks. Some of them have scraped their feathered crowns almost bald. Their occasional reward is a treasure like the object in Peter's palm, one more tough vitamin capsule, a husk with a few kernels no one else has eaten. In the Grants' first 4 years on this island, they never saw the struggle for existence get this intense. Those were good years for Darwin's finches. By the end of the Grants' first season, for instance, there were about 1,500 fortis on Daphne Major. 9 out of 10 of those fortis were still alive in December, just before the next rains came. There were also about 300 cactus finches on the island that first April, and 19 out of 20 of them survived the dry season and made it through to December. Their fourth year in 1976 was especially wet and green. There were great bouts of rain in January and February, and light showers in April and May, a total of 137 millimeters of rain, which is a good year for Darwin's finches. The fifth year of the study, 1977, began well, too. Rain fell right on schedule in the first week of January. Within days, green leaves unfolded and flower buds opened all over Daphne Major, with here and there a few caterpillars crawling on the buds, fast food for Darwin's finches. There were more than 1,000 fortis and almost 300 cactus finches on the island. By this time, the Grants' first pair of colleagues in the islands, Ian and Lynette Abbott, had gone back to Australia, and Jamie Smith had gone back to Canada. The Daphne Watch had been taken over by Peter Boag and Laureen Ratcliffe. Boag was eager for the island's fortis to start laying eggs because he needed more parents and offspring for his study. He had also received special permission from the staff of the National Park Service of Ecuador to perform his egg-switching experiment. After the fortis eggs hatched, he was planning to band the foster chicks. The next season, he would measure their beaks' length, depth, width, and finish his PhD with a bang. After the first rain, a few pairs of cactus finches mated. Cactus finches often breed before much rain has fallen, perhaps because they make most of their living from cactus. The birds laid their eggs in nests they built in the cactus trees, and the eggs hatched fine. Fortis do not breed until a little more rain has fallen. Peter and Laureen waited for the next good cloudburst, the one that would trigger the Fortis to mate. But after the first week of January, the sky above Daphne Major was like the sky that hangs over the Grants this morning. Gray, low, and gloomily quiet. There was one more shower, a very light one, then nothing but clouds and heat. The small rain that fell in the first week of the year did not settle into the soil. There is no place on Daphne's slopes for water to pool, and there is not much dirt to soak it up. The rain ran down the sides of the volcano as if pouring off a roof and trickled away into the sea. Whatever was left was baked away by the sun or dried in the sea breezes on the rim and in the eddying winds that circle within the great bowl of the crater, stirred as if by a fire in the crater bowl each morning as the rising sun begins to heat the lava. Peter and Laureen checked on the nests when the cactus finch chicks were 7 days old. Cactus finches build domed nests deep inside the cactus bushes, where they are well protected from owls. The chicks were peeping away with as much energy as they do every year. Peter and Laureen reached into each cactus bush, lifted the chicks out, set them down in a hat, and measured them one by one. In a normal year, flies and moths would have been flitting around the cactus trees by now, and the chicks' mothers and fathers would have been bringing bugs to the chicks. The air should have been so thick with bugs that 3 sweeps of a net through the air would come up with hundreds. But at the end of that January, the island was still so dry that there were few flowers to bring out the insects. 3 sweeps of the net came up with only a couple of bugs. When Boag and Ratcliffe sampled the contents of the chicks' crops with an eyedropper, they saw that most were almost empty. They found a little pollen, a few bits of flowers, or a seed kernel, sometimes a small spider. All over Daphne, leaves shriveled, flowers wilted. Boag and Ratcliffe had not planned to stay on the island this long. The way things usually went, they would go early in the year and band the fledglings in their nests on the 7th day. Then they would leave the island and come back later on to see how all the young birds were doing. But this year, Peter and Laureen were stuck. They could not leave the island until the Fortis had their fledglings. From the upper rim of the crater, Boag watched the horizon. The wind usually comes from the south, and it is blocked by the much larger and taller island of Santa Cruz, which lies 8 kilometers to the windward of Daphne Major. Storms drop most of their rain on the south side of Santa Cruz, so that the north side of the Big Island and all of Daphne Major lies in a rain shadow. Boag could see regular downpours along the coast of Santa Cruz. The island of Santiago, 30 kilometers to the northwest, where Darwin passed a fortnight, got soaked too that spring. "We panted, drank water, and read books," says Laureen. "I read The Agony and the Ecstasy. Peter read every single book on World War II. That's the place to read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich," says Peter. A few scattered showers fell on a few scattered days, 24 millimeters of rain in all. This was not enough to move the Fortis to pair off and mate, and it was not enough to fill the air with moths and flies. 2 out of 3 of the cactus finches' chicks died in the nest, and those fledglings that did make it out stayed close to their parents for twice as long as usual, some of them for more than a month. They hopped beside their mothers and fathers and begged with piercing cries and much shaking of their wings. During the previous June, when the island was wet and green, there had been more than 10 grams of seeds in an average square meter of lava. The finches had already eaten their way through many of those seeds during the dry season of 1976. Even if the rains had fallen as late as March or April of 1977, the seed supply would soon have rebounded, and the Fortis would have begun to pair off and breed and lay eggs for Boag's experiment. But the weeks went by, and the rains did not come, and the birds did not pair off. Day after day they went on pecking over the same square meters for the same diminishing supply of seeds. By June of that year, there were only 6 grams of seeds per square meter. By December, there would be only 3 grams. As they always do in dry times, the birds went on looking for the easiest seeds. But now they were sharing the last of the pistachio nuts. They were down to the bottom of the bowl. In June of the previous year, 4 out of 5 seeds that a finch picked up were easy, scoring less than 1 on the struggle index. But as the small, soft, easy seeds of Heliotropium and other plants disappeared, the rating climbed and climbed, peaking above 6. The birds were forced to struggle with the big, tough seeds of the Palo Santo and the cactus and tribulus, symbol of the struggle for existence, a seed sheathed in swords. Back in 1973, it had been quite rare to see a fortis try to crack one of the iron stars of the tribulus, and when one of the birds did try, it needed an average of almost 15 seconds to crack the mericarp. Boag and Ratcliffe got out the stopwatch again. A fortis could now get the side of its beak across a corner of a mericarp and twist, twist, until the capsule chipped in less than 6 seconds. The birds were getting a lot of practice with tribulus. That is, those birds that could handle it at all. Some of the very smallest fortis on the island, the ones whose beaks were too small for caltrop, were poking around the chamaisae instead. The herb chamaisae has small, soft seeds, but it also has a milky, sticky latex when its leaves are wounded and its stems are broken. These little fortis, along with the very smallest birds on the island, the immigrant Fuliginosa, began hunting for seeds in the chamaisae in spite of its latex. The feathers on the crowns of their heads got so matted, gummy, and sticky that they rubbed off afterward as the birds raked the cinders and gravel looking for more seeds. Their bare scalps were exposed to the sun all day. Boag and Ratcliffe began to find little bald finches lying dead on the lava. They kept up the routine of capturing and measuring finches, dangling them in the weighing cup and recording the numbers in their waterproof notebooks. That year they did not need them to be waterproof. By June, many of the birds' weights were down as much as a quarter from the June before. A large number of these finches had failed to molt, although by now they badly needed a new set of feathers. Some of their contour feathers were so worn that the down underneath was exposed, as Boag would report later in his now famous paper on the drought of 1977. He and Laureen found dead fortis lying on the lava with feathers so disheveled they looked as if they had been combed the wrong way. The fraying of feathers was hardest on the smallest species, the Fuliginosa, which when not eating the small, soft seeds of chamaisae, were poking about for bugs in the lichen on the torchwood trees, Boag says, or hawking for bugs from a naked branch. They needed all their contour feathers for flight. Even in good years, finch watchers have to be careful never to leave a bucket of water standing open in camp, or Darwin's finches will jump in and drown. On one island, another Galapagos biologist, an iguana watcher, did leave a jerry can open once, and in the morning it was full of finches. The bucket is like an oasis. It draws thirsty animals from far and wide. Once at the Charles Darwin Research Station, a centipede a foot long crawled into an open bucket, and as the grasshoppers hopped in, the centipede ate them one by one. This year, the whole camp on Daphne Major became an oasis of sorts. A flock of finches, mostly juveniles, birds born the green year before, hung around the finch watcher's tent and picked up crumbs. Peter and Laureen grew particularly attached to one female finch. Number 1750 or something like that, Boag says. She would follow us around the camp. She didn't make it through the drought, unfortunately. Down on the crater floor, the blue-footed boobies shifted their weight from one leg to the other to cool off their webbed feet. Boag stuck a thermometer into the ground, in the tortured shadow of a cactus, and the soil was hotter than 50 degrees centigrade, 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Even when there were seeds lying out in the open, The heat was keeping the finches from foraging there between the hours of 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Meanwhile, at night, Peter and Laureen would be shivering in their tent if temperatures got down to 75 degrees Fahrenheit, because their bodies were so used to the heat. Boag lay awake and wondered how his flocks were doing, just as biblical shepherds once did in a far distant desert. In the day, the drought consumed me, and the frost by night. Now and then, a frigate bird harried a blue-footed booby out of its kill of fish. If the fish dropped on the island, as many as 10 or 20 finches would flock around it. They also scavenged broken eggs and fresh booby guano. They hung close when the boobies fed their young and fought for the fish scraps, and when owls left something of their kill, finches fought over that too. In other years, the finches had ignored the lava lizards that scuttle about the rocks. But once that year, Peter and Laureen saw a female cactus finch eating a black lizard tail, and nearby they spotted a female lizard with a freshly broken stump. Some days later, they saw the same bird chase after another female lava lizard, pecking at its tail. She might have started a new entry on the finch menu, but that was the end of the episode. Another time, they saw a blue-footed booby wounded by a frigate bird. A fortis stood beneath the wounded booby and drank the blood as it dripped on a rock. "We just sat there month after month," Boag says. "At the time, we were depressed. We were losing the breeding season, so we wouldn't get a generation. Plus, all these birds were disappearing. We kept up doing the normal checks and censuses, but our feeling was not the thrill of seeing evolution in action, as one might conclude from reading the subsequent papers, but the moderate despair of doing a research project and seeing your birds dying." All of the cactus finch fledglings died before they were 3 months old. Not a single fortis laid an egg or built a nest. Of course, this was the whole design of the study, to watch and see, on spec, says Boag, if there were going to be any minor selective episodes. But now that a selective episode was definitely in progress, Boag was wretched. The egg switch would have been a wonderful experiment, and he was sure that watching natural selection in action would never make him Dr. Boag. At best, the events that he and Laureen were documenting this year would make a page of someone else's thesis a long way down the road. "We thought it very unlikely that we'd be able to measure it at all," Boag says. "We thought, watch 10 years, and then maybe. So I didn't recognize what was going on, the magnitude of the effect."